The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
So it's become apparent that there's something wrong with modern morality. There is something wrong with what we think in which the good life consists. And in the very nature of how we describe what is and is not moral. And this was the fundamental thesis of Alistair MacIntyre's book, After Virtue, in which he posits a thought experiment. And I wanted to take you through this because I really think there's something to this. He suggests that imagine there was a complete collapse of science, and not only was science not done, there was an anti-science movement that spent its time trying to tear up what science had discovered and cast it to history, so it's completely lost. And then once this madness had passed, people tried to reconstruct the lost science. They would find parts of textbooks, they would find old recordings, they would find certain studies, and slowly but surely begin to reconstruct what science was out of the ashes of these ruins. But they would only be partial, there would never be a full understanding of the theories. And so they would use words like, you know, atomic theory or whatever, I'm not a scientist, they would use scientific words, but they wouldn't really have a full understanding of those scientific words. And so once they'd at least partially reconstructed all of this, would you be able to call that science? And the answer is, of course, no, because the new reconstructed scientific theories would probably not have the same qualities and effects that actual proper science does. And Alistair MacIntyre's contention was that this is what has happened to morality in the modern world. At some point in the last few hundred years, morality has actually been under attack. It has been deconstructed. It has been essentially lost to history. And we still now, in the modern era, we are now trying, for some reason still, to reconstruct morality. We are trying to understand what morality is. And you hear this from the left all the time. They're constantly talking about the progress of their politics and their morals. And you think, okay, but it's been thousands of years. How have we not worked out what it is to be a good person yet? And the answer is, of course, that we have. This was just destroyed in the paradigm shift from the traditional way of being into liberal modernity. And now the liberal moderns have a very weird view on what it is to be a good person. In fact, you'll notice that instead of the judgment-based morality dominates. And if you read anything from a few hundred years ago, you realize that they are very, very judgmental in their language. And it's because they themselves are trained to make judgments of their own about what is right and wrong, what is good and bad. And you'll notice that this is something that we just don't do now. What we have now is a kind of rules-based morality, the morality of the civic bureaucracy, which in and of itself is fundamentally exculpatory, as if to say, morality is not your personal judgment. So you are the person upon whom the judgment ultimately lies. If you judge right or wrong, you might make a wrong judgment and you might make a bad call and you might have to apologize for that. But then it's you that's the person who is the agent there. Instead, morality has become externalized. It is a series of rules imposed by an authority. So you personally can't really be judged right or wrong for following these rules, because this was what morality was taught to you as. And I think this is just fundamentally incorrect. I just think this is completely fundamentally incorrect as to what morality actually consists in. But moreover, I think it makes bad people. I think this is the formula to create people who are, at best, just compliant rule followers who can exist within a giant bureaucracy without causing any disturbance to the bureaucracy itself. But I don't think it actually makes the people good. I don't think it makes them happy. And I don't think it makes them moral. And that's why I asked Stelios to write me a course on how to be moral. Because, thankfully, we happen to have a long history, written history of morality that we can actually call upon here, and we can actually reconstruct it ourselves. So I asked him to do me a course on ancient Greek virtue ethics, because I'm sure you're all aware I'm quite besotted with Aristotle, and I think that basically all of moral learning ends there, and everything since has been a waste of time. Although he might correct me on that, but I genuinely have come to that conclusion. And so I asked him to write me a course on ancient Greek virtue ethics, because he happens to be an Athenian philosopher with a PhD in philosophy. So who better to do it?
Well, thank you very much for this. The course and the preparation for it and recording it was an incredible experience, and I'm very grateful for this. So I think that you mentioned some really important points that definitely need addressing, and they are things that I saw when I was teaching philosophy, and there were problems that I encountered while I was in academia. And I'm actually writing a book for some time now about how the dominant intellectual trends of both analytic and continental philosophy, that is Anglo-Saxonic philosophy and also continental European philosophy of the 20th century, are literally sabotaging people from understanding themselves as beings of worth and as beings with rights and responsibilities. They usually think of the former instead of think of both.
I mean, if you look at our entire political discourse at the moment, it is nothing but rights claims.
Yes.
I have a right to this because.
Exactly.
That's, again, where is the morality in this? Where is the judgment in this? Where is the actual argument about right and wrong?
Exactly. And in contemporary culture, especially in alternative spaces, we have people constantly talking about the evils of continental philosophy, such as critical race theory, neo-Marxism, postmodernism, but very few people talk about analytic philosophy, and very few people talk about what's there, which isn't so much directly problematic as it is fundamentally indirectly problematic. Mm. I think that this is what destroyed the defenses that we as Westerners had against the subversion that many people consciously try to do, coming from continental philosophy and other areas of the world.
But just a quick thing on that as well. A third point is there's no alternative. No one ever seems to actually create a substantive alternative to these structures.
Well, that's the idea we are destroying with this course, and we are trying to recapture the spirit of antiquity and some of the fundamental pillars of Western civilization.
Yes.
A civilization we are told constantly that is being uniquely guilty and also that it doesn't exist.
Yes.
So the fundamental problem I find with analytic philosophy is ontological materialism. There's no other way of saying it. When people enter the stage where they start thinking about things and want to form a worldview and ask themselves, right, how do I guide my thinking about becoming a good person and about becoming a good moral agent? Chances are that they're going to walk into a bookshop or watch a video on YouTube by people telling them that essentially the deflated view of humanity is unproblematically true. That all there is to human beings is just a meat machine, and just there is no value there. That the self doesn't exist. The self is an illusion. Well, if it's an illusion, who is deluded? That's not a question that they ever care to answer. And also the idea that morality just doesn't fit well into the materialistic universe. And let me just be very clear, because I want to be very exact and precise in what I say. I think that I don't say that every person who's a materialist is immoral. I am saying that to the extent that they are moral, they're moral despite their materialism, not because of it.
I think I often view a lot of these people as neither being moral nor immoral, because it's all focused around harm reduction and the obedience to the bureaucratic rules. And so that doesn't actually require them to make any particular judgments or actually positively act in a way that we could consider moral. And so, okay, you didn't do anything wrong, but what did you do that was good?
Yes, I think that this is fundamentally the template for becoming a crazed fanatic ideologue.
I agree.
The rules account for everything. Mm-hmm. If the rules don't account for it, it doesn't exist. When reality clashes with theory, so where's for reality?
Yes.
That's the mind template of a fanatic ideologue.
But also you can see how it gives them license to invade every space that doesn't follow these rules.
Yes.
I have essentially sanctified the rules. The rules are my entire moral universe.
Exactly.
And so if you're not following these rules, then they think of us in the same way that the conquistadors thought of the Aztecs sacrificing children, right?
Absolutely.
They view us in that way. And that is, I just do not think that is a moral stance. I think that's actually a bureaucratic stance.
It is not a moral stance. I think it's the extreme manifestation of the stance we're talking about. Mm. And essentially, it gives us license to forego judgment.
Yes.
To stop judging. And one of the reasons...
That's the entire point of it, in fact. Yeah. The entire point is to prevent us from judging, to impose this repressive tolerance in which literally
Absolutely.
Everyone is allowed to do anything as long as it's within the rules. Even though the things they're doing themselves might be completely degenerate, just utterly immoral in every way, shape or form.
Exactly. And there is something that is simultaneously metaphysical and ethical there. According to this point, according to which we can just forego judgment because the rules unproblematically apply on every situation, there is a metaphysics according to which no particulars exist. It's only universals that exist. Every specific thing that possesses any kind of particularity doesn't exist unless it can be understood as a just bundle of relations.
And the thing is, as well, it's intrinsic to the very nature of following and setting rules that they have to be for all people in all times. You can't have a rule for Mike Smith that stipulates him and rules for him alone. That's not a rule, then. That's a privilege, actually. Something
yes.
else.
Yes.
So the very nature of the thing has to be universalizable.
Exactly. And when we're talking about universality... Let's say that not all forms of universality are wrong. But when we talk about a universality that doesn't recognize, and in fact is hostile to, the irreducible particularities of human life, such as individuality.
I mean, literally every person's actual life.
Exactly.
The actual content of their lives is irreducibly particular. No one has your life. You don't have anyone else's life. And so you can't just assume there is an abstract set of rules that answers every question in every scenario that you will ever encounter.
Exactly. And when we do this, it's not just individuality when we're talking about a person. Mm. It's also the individuality of one's family.
Yep.
The individuality of one's community.
I mean, it's literally
individuality of one's nation.
It's your entire history leading up until that point and everything that has happened in it.
Exactly.
That is in any way conceivable. And even those things that you don't really conceive of that happen to you without your knowledge. All of these things.
And this is because to a very large extent in materialism, if we combine this kind of materialism with the other kind of idealism, which is only universals exist, yeah. It's a very dangerous mix. Some people call it dialectical materialism. It's not just that, but there are more trends that lead to there. We lose what is fundamentally true about every human life, individually speaking, and we treat everyone as the same, as being just weight.
Well, this is how you arrive at the sort of modern liberal experience of humans being interchangeable, fungible widgets that can just be swapped over.
Yes, exactly. And modern liberalism has the idea of lack of desert for one's actions. It's not a coincidence that John Rawls, who is basically the patron saint of modern liberalism, with his 1971 published A Theory of Justice, he fundamentally disagrees with the notion that we have free will in any important sense. And he thinks that we don't deserve our the fruit of our labor. Because if we produce more than others and earn more than others, for instance, in the economic reality, that is just a feature of things that we cannot control. We had a better upbringing, we had a better, we were more lucky, and everything that revolves around that idea that we are not the authors of our own action. I don't disagree with the idea that we are shaped by our environment.
Sure, but that's not what he's saying, is it? Because this goes far further than this. Because, of course, you know, okay, yeah, you had to have a certain material base, as Aristotle might think of it, to be able to achieve and accomplish certain things in life, like to become a philosopher, for example. But it still was your personal agency and your technique, your practice, your learning, your discipline, and your knowledge that gets you to where you are. You are entitled to that. And if you're not entitled to that, why am I able to say that someone else isn't entitled to what you have? And so basically you strip away that thing from the people who are actually deserving, but you also create a space for the people who are undeserving to lay claim to this as well.
Exactly. And let us say this, it's again the metaphysics behind it that is sabotaging people from understanding themselves as moral agents with rights and responsibilities. Yeah. Because if we see the implication of it, draw the inferences from the materialistic assumptions, we'll see that agency itself is way more passive than we think of it.
Yes.
Agency is just billiard ball-like movement. Yeah. If I move and I'm an agent, it's because I'm entirely necessitated or caused by factors that are not apt to me.
You were deterministically preconfigured to become what you are now. And the thing is, I mean, I've just finished my master's degree in philosophy. And man, I'm telling you,
congratulations.
Nothing, thank you. I've got to do my exam yet. There's nothing predetermined about or necessary about me having done it. It was a lot of work. I had to slog through God only knows how many books and think very deeply about the subject that I was covering. And so the idea, just the fundamental idea that actually agency isn't a core part of humanity and a core part of morality is just wrong.
Yep.
It's just fundamentally wrong.
That's the issue. And that's what happened in the beginning of modernity, because modernity and the Enlightenment are a combination of the Renaissance and the scientific revolution.
Yep.
And the Renaissance does have the element of returning to antiquity, which was very problematically fused with the scientific revolution. That's why I think that a lot of Enlightenment philosophy is actually very good, but it's completely problematic in how it synthesizes into a whole vision of life. That's why what you mentioned in the beginning as an idea from Alasdair MacIntyre, fragmentation of the modern worldview, is very much correct. And we can't stress enough how correct it is.
Yes.
And how important it is.
Well, on that note, I agree with you that a lot of Enlightenment philosophy is actually very clever. Yeah. I think in many ways it's kind of misappropriated. I mean, take the example of Rousseau. He really likes Sparta, really likes the idea of a tightly controlled city-state with a permanently invested political class. So, okay, yeah, I can see the appeal and I can see why you'd like it, but you can't apply it to a nation like France that has 50 million people or whatever it was in his time and is a gargantuan area. That you can't do that.
Exactly. And that was fundamentally Benjamin Constant's reaction against Rousseau, is that, you know, the world has changed.
Yes.
Modern Frenchmen are not ancient Spartans.
Yes.
That's, you know, when they thought they were ancient Spartans and acted as if they were, lots of heads were chopped.
Yes. Yes. Yes, they were. So this is, I think, a really good place to begin to really explain what it is we can actually do about this. Because I really do, when I began doing my degrees, I'd never properly read any of the things that I was dealing with. And so I was forced to read through the liberal canon. And it became apparent to me that actually this was basically just a kind of a very advanced conflict resolution mechanism, which, okay, that's fine. And, you know, we want to resolve conflicts. But on a day-to-day basis, liberalism just cannot tell you what you ought to be doing.
Yeah.
And it can't tell you how to do it outside of the scope of a series of rules. And actually, if you think about what most of your daily life entails, you don't really engage with the rules that much, actually. You know, normally most of your life is contained outside of engagement with the laws, with the state bureaucracy, with whatever it is that is imposed from without upon you. Most of your life is actually you making decisions. Yeah. And so how do we make good decisions? What is a good decision? And I've seen it so many times in my own life. Like I've got cousins who I know when we were younger made bad decisions, and they had a very different life trajectory to me. And, you know, I'm very glad that I made good decisions, but I didn't know why I was making these decisions. And so I think this is what actually I was asking for with the course on ancient Greek philosophy, because I think actually it comes down to basically your ability to make virtuous choices.
Absolutely. I think that it's a very straightforward thing to explain. I think the first thing is to diagnose the problem and then propose a solution. And it's not a novel solution. It's a very traditional.
It's an ancient solution.
And
but it's well tried and tested.
And it works.
Yeah, it's tried and tested. That's the thing. We know it works.
Exactly. It works. And just apply it in your life and tell us see if it works. It does.
Yeah, your life will get better from this.
Yes. So the thing is that from a first person perspective, which is the only perspective
you will ever have.
We're agents with moral responsibilities, and our actions are up to us to a very large extent.
Almost entirely.
We have to be the authors of our own action.
Yes.
And to a very large extent, we have to take responsibility for our own lives. And I think there comes a point when we mature where we start saying, right, okay, however I may have been mistreated or unfairly treated by my family, by my friends, or by my society, I need to stop complaining about everything, and I need to live my life as if it's entirely dependent upon my choice.
Yes.
I think people who think this way thrive. People who start complaining all the time, they can sometimes become DI officers, but generally speaking, they don't live a happy life.
They join the lanyard class and they become very depressed and they have to go see their therapists.
Exactly.
You're absolutely correct on this. This is exactly correct. Because I can't help but notice that much of the destructive forces in modern society and our politics are built on envy and resentment and other negative emotions that are nurtured in the hearts of these people instead of actually, I don't know, expressing a bit of forgiveness and working to become better people, and instead of pressing rights claims out of grievances, you could actually become a virtuous person that everyone would recognize intrinsically as a virtuous person.
I think you're right. And I think that this envy and resentment comes straightforwardly from the idea that one isn't an agent of their own lives.
Yes.
That it's others that have to give me what I want to be given without ever asking myself whether I deserve to be given.
And this is the very nature of victimhood.
Exactly.
Someone did something to me. So I'm not the agent here. Someone is the agent here. And now I have a rights claim. And this is what all of these right claims are fundamentally predicated on, a sense of victimhood. I am the victim of the state. I'm the victim of white supremacy, whatever they want to call it. And therefore, give.
Exactly. And let us mention one of the extreme manifestations of this mentality, which is the activist, according to whom everything in the world must change before their lives personally change. It's unless you live in communist utopia, you cannot ever experience true relationships with human being. And unless you are in communist utopia, morality doesn't really apply, because we are in a condition of emergency and warfare.
And you can see why these people are so miserable.
Exactly.
I mean, that is a huge ask.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, or you can work on being a good person in your own life with your own relationships, with them, with the options available to you, and actually after a year of doing it, you'll realize, and honestly, and genuinely, this is what I did back in 2019, 2020, when I started my course. I just started thinking about it and just really focusing on, okay, no, I'm actually going to take Aristotle very seriously. I don't want defect or excess. I want to do things to the right amount for the right reasons to get the right results. And I think it's really worked for me. I mean, I've got all this, you know. So all I'm saying is this is my personal philosophy we're talking about.
And I think you're right. And to get back to what we were talking about before, it's we need to first understand the diagnosis, the problem. We need to have a diagnosis and then give the solution of that is the time-tested one that we're giving with the course. Now, the problem is that when we enter modernity and we couple the Renaissance with the scientific revolution, essentially we understand everything in terms of a materialistic, like, billiard balls nature of the universe. Everything becomes billiard balls.
Yes.
Billiard balls. Now, not every Enlightenment thinker had that thought, but that was the basis where they were gravitating towards, because they had embraced some assumptions that lead there by logical necessity. Right. So if we embrace this and we understand and we try to understand the human mind materialistically, we're constantly locked in the effort of reducing everything that is first personal to third personal language. To language that doesn't involve anything that is mind related.
Yes.
And that can't happen.
No.
And it can't happen when it comes to agency, when it comes to normativity, because all agency becomes billiard ball like movement, which isn't really agency, it's just movement.
No, it's determinism.
And exactly. And also, when it comes to normativity, we have the ease-ought problem that Hume mentioned, that if you break down everything to physical factors, it all just becomes movement and just particles coming together and being torn apart. You don't have the sense of wrongness or rightness of action. It's just things change.
You've drained the moral content out of the universe.
Absolutely.
That's the issue.
And
so you can't draw the ought, the moral ought, from what's materially there, because none of it has any moral substance of its own.
Exactly. And if we end up in an effort to reduce all first personal notions and everything that appears to us in the first person, such as our agency and our moral responsibility, into third person language, we're going to lose morality for the following reasons. For the following reason, that movement, the movement of atomic particles is neither right or wrong. It just is. So if we try to understand human action and human interaction and human society in terms of the motion of particles, we're never going to be able to understand it as the interaction of morally responsible agents. Agents who have moral responsibility for making the world a bit better than they found it.
And moreover, it actually intrinsically reduces a person's ability to even conceive of themselves that way. Because under the external rules-based exculpatory system of liberal morality, actually being moral is essentially a form of non-agency. It's a form of not moving. The most moral thing you can do is to not infringe on anyone else's rights or on their feelings or whatever it is that people feel infringed upon, rather than actual true morality, which is positive, affirmative. It requires you to have done something. A moral agent is not someone who is harmless. A moral agent, as Jordan Peterson famously puts it, is someone who could choose to do wrong, but chooses to do right instead. And so it's a completely, the modern view of morality is completely backwards and trends definitionally towards passivity, as in you don't act and you are good, you do act, and intrinsically there's something negative about it.
Or we have the very activist sense that you have to act, but you have to act in ways that are almost entirely in conflict with traditional morality.
But if you look at that, they're not even really acting, though, are they? They don't think of the way that they deal with other people as good or bad. What they're doing is just making demands of the system for extra rules to allow them to allow them to fall back into this passivity, so they don't actually have to take control and go and take command of their own moral compass.
I think you have a point there, because one thing I constantly see is people thinking that the act of legislating
is somehow morality.
Sufficient action
yeah.
for something. Whereas, you know, just it's not sufficient. It's just the first step in a journey of 1,000 miles, because you have to constantly police the law
yeah.
and enforce the law and interpret the law. And it's this interpretation of moral laws, just like interpretation of positive laws, that is necessary for judgment and seeing how to apply them in society.
And moreover,
this is an element that we completely lose when we have a metaphysical worldview that leads us into thinking that there's no particularity.
But also,
it's all just, you just know the moral law, you legislate the moral law, and that's it.
But you've got to constantly expand the law as well. Yeah. Because the world is constantly changing and things are constantly happening. And if more and more of the moral decision-making and judgment is essentially offloaded to the state, to the rules, to the bureaucracy, well, okay, yeah, we're going to need lots of new laws to judge the personal interactions that people are having with one another. And so the whole thing becomes far more complex and more burdensome than it ever would have been in any other era. And it, by necessity, it has to become that way. So this whole paradigm, frankly, I think is trending towards tyranny necessarily. There's no way out of it. Because once you've assumed this rules-based view of morality, well, then you create people who only respond to the rules-based view of morality. They only understand this. And so now your rules have to be comprehensive for a human life. Whereas actually, traditionally, morality was something that people did with one another, and they were the ones responsible for actually making judgments. You know, have I wronged you? Well, I can make restitution. I can apologize. I can take you out for dinner or something. You know, yeah. It's a show of apology, of contrition. Like, that. No external rules arbiter needs to be involved in this. This is a decision that we make between ourselves. And we're creating people who are just not able to do that.
And just to add to this, because I think that it's an important qualification to make, so no misrepresentation occurs, when you're saying that it's not just a matter of rules, I think you're correct, but what I get from you is not that having rules is bad.
No, there has to be some rules.
Exactly,
but
there have to be, but they... For some reason, they constantly expand to become very totalistic and totalitarian.
Well, it's because the only aspect of morality in modernity are the rules themselves. It's not the character of the people following the rules. Because the thing about a rule is it actually has nothing to say about the individual to whom it applies. This is a boundary. This is a barrier. You cross it or you don't cross it. And if you cross it, I'm going to consider you bad and I'm going to punish you. But if you don't cross it, I still have nothing to say about the kind of person that you are, the character of that person. So you could be the world's worst welfare sponge. You've spent your entire life on benefits. You've got a government house and all you do is smoke weed and drink and play video games and, you know, throw rubbish out of your window. But if that's not against the rules, then that person is just as good a person as the person who gets up at 6 a.m., has a shower, goes for a run, makes sure their kids have got breakfast on the table, goes out, works hard all day, then does charity in the evening. Those people are moral equivalents in the rules-based order, and that's the problem with the rules-based order.
And the who are you to judge mentality.
Absolutely.
And the just leave them alone mentality.
Absolutely. I'm a person with judgment, which is why I am a person to judge. And I have decided that I am the moral arbiter in the interactions in my life. I'm the guy who gets to decide what's morality. And so are you. And so are you. And this is why we all need to have this kind of conversation.
And to get back to the solution that we find in tradition, we can enter this, and I'll speak in language that I think that lots of people within a naturalistic society will understand, because the current intellectual metaphysics is naturalistic metaphysics.
Yeah.
And it says essentially everything is nature. And the advocates of naturalism are basically saying that every previous thinker thought that we're somehow unproblematically disconnected with nature. I think that this is a wrong criticism. It's a mistaken criticism of pre-naturalistic metaphysics. And what is interesting and what has been completely lost with the metaphysics, the materialistic metaphysics of the scientific revolution onwards, is that it destroys every hierarchy other than, except for hierarchies of complexity. So according to the traditional understanding of the universe, metaphysics and ethics were sort of the one and the same thing.
Yeah, there's no distinction between them.
The universe was a rigidly structured, a hierarchically structured entity. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a lump of things.
Yep.
That was completely disordered, and to the extent that it accommodates complexity, it's only to the extent that it accommodates hierarchies, they're only hierarchies of complexity. Yes. Just like we listen constantly to Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris talking about very complex brain processes.
Sure.
These are the only complexities that they talk about. But from a traditional perspective, we are members of the universe. In a sense, we are a mirror of the universe. And we are structured beings. And our structure reflects the structures of value of the universe. The fundamental question in Platonism is upwards or downwards, because Plato is constantly talking about people living in the world who make moral choices, and the choices are whether, or the fundamental choice is whether they're going to live as virtuous people or as vicious people.
So let me jump in there, because this I think is a very interesting thing, because as you say, the materialists are looking at the universe as just hierarchies of complexity. Is this particular thing simple or complex? And they can judge based on that. But human beings live in a metaphysical reality that is imbued with morality.
Exactly.
And almost everything about your life on a day-to-day basis is actually metaphysically moral, or has a metaphysical moral valence to it. So, for example, I wake up in the morning next to my wife. The very sentence there is loaded with metaphysical morality. My wife is a node in this network of morality, and I have obligations to her. She has obligations to me, and we live in a moral hierarchy that's fundamentally social. So the next group of people that will be introduced into that hierarchy are, of course, my children, and they occupy a lower station in this hierarchy to me, which means I now have obligations to them morally in order to make sure they're fed, clothed, but guided correctly, taught well in morality and how to deal with each other and then other people, moving out and into an irreducibly complex moral network landscape that we exist on. So this idea that we can just somehow, if we just compress everything down into a rules-based order, so actually it's, do you follow the rule or not, that is just not sufficient to live a good life.
It's not. And let us be very clear with respect to what is happening. I think almost everyone except psychopaths have a moral conscience.
Yes.
And they do have, and they do experience, as agents who experience life from the first person, what we're talking about, you know, the experience of what is the right thing to do. And they have an intuitive understanding of how this occasionally clashes with some desires that may be very strong. Right. If we embrace the materialistic metaphysics of the scientific revolution, the extreme materialism that comes from it, we are going to view the human being as just a bundle of passions.
Yes.
A clash of desires, a battleground of conflicting desires. And the strong desire will win. As Hobbes says, the will is the strongest desire that will lead to action. Whereas Hume says afterwards, I think about 100 years after Hobbes, maybe a bit less, he says that reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions. But his reason is a completely deflated notion of reason. It's not the traditional reason of Plato, Aristotle, Saint Augustine of Hippo, Saint Thomas Aquinas, or even Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. It's reason materialistically reduced into a complex sensory mechanism.
It's basically the sort of large language model view of reason, right? It's an AI view of reason, is essentially what he's coming to. But the reason I think this is so important is because the hierarchies of morality that we live in inform the kind of people that we become. because we move through these hierarchies. They change over the course of your life. And this is why character is so important. If your father is, for example, a deadbeat loser who drinks all day, doesn't get a job, doesn't, you know, make sure that you have the books that you need to learn at school, like, that's a moral failing on the part of the father. But the rules-based law says, well, he didn't commit a crime, so what's the problem, really? And so what we've done is equalized the moral character of the deadbeat dad and the good father who provides for his family. And this is my problem with the entire moral structure of modernity, frankly. It's like, no, there is a substantive moral difference between the two that was not necessary. It is necessarily different, but it was chosen. Each one chose to go down their different path. And this was based in their own personal virtues. They were the agents of their own lives. And we ought to make moral judgments ourselves between the good father who has provided for his family and pays his taxes and is a good citizen and husband, and the deadbeat who does nothing and just sponges off society.
So this worldview fundamentally disrespects agency as we experience it from the first person.
Yes.
That's the issue. And it happens because if we just collapse everything into a billiard ball-like universe, then there is no such thing as a noble or nobler aspect of the soul that tells me one thing, whereas less noble aspects of their soul may suggest something else, such as we find in the pre-modern traditions, almost every tradition.
What would the concept of nobility possibly mean if nobility is just following rules?
Yes, and the issue is that because they deny this the hierarchies of value, and they deny the reason traditionally conceived of, which was the noble element of the soul from Heraclitus up to Hume. Reason was the noble aspect of the soul, and it's sort of linked us somehow to the nobler natures, the higher verities in Plato, truth, beauty, and goodness. That was the voice that lifted us upwards. It exerted an upwards lifting influence.
It's what makes life better.
Exactly. But in modernity, in this framework, let me rephrase it this way, in this framework, it's all an issue of clashing desires, because there is no such thing as the noble reason of tradition that should rule the passions and should govern the passions. It's all clashing desires. And to the extent that we are beings with foresight and reason in that sense, reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions, according to Hume. So all desires are seeing as equal. There are no ways of ranking desires morally in ways that feature and are compatible with the metaphysical assumptions of who we actually are. So
this is so on the money. Explains everything about what's happening now.
Yeah, because the fundamental problem comes also with Kant afterwards, whose main problem was that he took Hume way too seriously. Yeah. He invents a philosophy and initiates a project according to which there is a fundamental gap between our experience and reality. Because what he says is we have to view the world as if we are moral agents, as if it's extended in time and space, as if time exists. There's always an as if clause. And Kant, I think Kant was someone who was a very profound philosopher.
Oh, he's a very smart chap.
Very smart. And he does have very insightful ethics.
He does.
But I think that he and Kant and Hume are the authors of this consciousness that doesn't feature in the world. But because it constantly views the world with an as if. We view the world as if this. So when I love my wife, from a modern perspective, I have to constantly have this thought in my mind that is just an imbalance of chemical in my brain.
That's totally true.
It brings everything down.
And moreover, notice that it's Kant that really instantiates the rules-based ethics as well. I mean, his entire categorical imperative is, can this be a universalizable rule? It's like, I don't know and I don't care. It might be the right thing to do for this person in this time, in this place, for this reason, because of the particular circumstances that brought this about. Even if that's not like, and this is obviously a common critique of Kant's rule-based system itself. But the point is, you can see that the only escape from where this was going is say, okay, well, we need universalizable rules, and that's in what morality consists. And that's just not correct. But anyway, so this I think is a really genuine problem. This is why I asked you to begin on this odyssey from the very beginning, because this has taken how long have we been working?
We're working on it for about a year.
Right. So this has taken a very long time. But it became apparent to me that we would need something like this, that we could say, look, you are basically trapped in a kind of mind fog of modernity. This is a deliberate attempt to reduce your personal agency and to make you not know what you ought to do with your life.
Yep.
And this is completely counter to what all ancient Greek philosophy basically was for, which was how to live a good life. The idea that a human life has a goal, what they would call a telos, is something that's completely absent to modern thinking about what it is to exist. You are just a bundle of desires, a fleshy sack that is seeking to satiate itself, and therefore get in the pod, eat the bugs, you know, watch the VR and consume the soma. It's like, sorry, I don't think that's actually a good life.
It's not a good life.
I think that's the opposite of a good life. It's a curse.
It's not a good life. It's the life of vice, according to Plato.
Yes.
And Aristotle, and basically all the ancients.
Yes.
And all the pre-moderns in their respect, because, and also for many modern philosophers, because if we are just a battlefield of conflicting desires, none of which are more noble than the others in ways that our view of the universe can sustain, well, let the strongest desire win by right of conquest.
And also, you can see why leftists and liberals are constantly on the side of the villains from this perspective, right? If there's no particular nobility to you doing the right thing and them doing the wrong thing, because they are just the conflict on the battlefield of desires, and the stronger desire, which we would consider negative, has won, well, then he's no less moral than you. He was just unfortunate. He is just a victim of circumstance. He was just, you know, so if we just give him enough, if we just satisfy the socioeconomic conditions, then he'll be less of a criminal. It's like, no, that's just not how it works, actually. It's about training in character. That's what all of morality actually is, in the way that you deal with things. And so basically what we are doing with this course is completely rejecting the modern paradigm of morality.
Yes.
Because it's wrong. It's just incorrect. And actually going back to a traditional virtue-based view of morality, because that is correct. That is actually how good people are made and what morality is actually contained.
And contrary to what many scholars think, resurrecting antiquity and going back to ancient Greek virtue ethics and ancient Greco-Roman virtue ethics is also capable of giving guidance to our lives and also capable of accommodating lots of the good elements of the Enlightenment and today. Because one of the constant criticisms of ancient virtue ethics is that it doesn't give you guidance to your life. I think it's the exact opposite.
It does. That's what it's for.
That's what they're saying. They're saying that it doesn't give you a rule to apply to every case.
That's true. It doesn't give you a rule to apply to every case. And what it does is fosters your judgment. So no matter what case you find yourself in, you can make a good decision.
Yeah. So I think that, as you said, with this course, we're fundamentally rejecting the modern paradigm in its entire philosophy.
Yes.
Its entire philosophy.
Root and branch.
Exactly, because the problem is, as you mentioned with McIntyre in the beginning, and the really great and profound thought experiment that he starts his After Virtue with, is that human beings have a tendency towards wholeness and completion. Yes. That's why we, as he also says, we cannot but experience our lives in narrative form.
Correct.
As a complete story with beginning, middle, and end, and an ending.
And there's so much extra that could be said about the narrative view of life as well. We won't get into it now.
Yeah.
But honestly, after reading After Virtue, I've been on this journey myself to get to that point. And so reading McIntyre basically put the sort of capstone on my own view on this. I was like, yeah, no, everything actually is stories. We can't, there's no context and understanding of anything if it's not in a narrative. Like, you don't know why are you here, Stelis? Well, you know why you're here, because you've got a story of how you got here. And you watching, you've all got the same. So it's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, God, we the sort of atomic modern view of what a human being is, and each event is just so wrong. But that's I'm going off on a side tangent now. Sorry, Karen.
No, but just to let me add to this, there is a human need for completion, yes. And there is a human need for a wholeness. And the fragmentation of our modern worldview is creating lots of troubles for it.
Completely.
And
this is a quick example of this. I keep seeing articles of aging millennial women who are now getting to their 40s and being like, well, I'm a girl boss who is earning 100 grand a year. Why can't I find a husband? It's like, because you didn't have a plan for your life. You didn't think, okay, when I'm at that age, how will I have a certain set of goods that I want to have? It's like, well, you didn't take any of the actions required to get to that place. And now you've taken, in fact, a series of counteractions that actually prevent you from getting to that place. And you're wondering, well, why aren't I there? It's because you were raised in a society that did not prepare you to get the things you actually want.
Exactly.
You were completely misled, frankly.
You didn't view life as a whole. You viewed life just from actions and outcomes,
but
in very short term.
But it's immediate. Exactly. And the thing is, my whole life, I think back, my whole life in modern Western democracies, you are just taught not to worry about the future. There's just no concern. No,
you absolutely should worry about it.
Well, of course, obviously, you know,
it's your life. If it's not important to you,
exactly, who is it important to? Right.
Important
but this is the thing. It everything is about just satisfying the primary desire that you're feeling at the moment.
Yes, right?
That's what everything is based around. And it's like, okay, well, I'm not saying that doesn't feel good, but you will wish. I mean, I wasted my 20s. I wasted my 20s living in that paradigm because I was just like, okay, well, I'll just work whatever I need, the bare minimum to sustain myself. And then I'll just, you know, play my video games. I'll just drink beer. I'll just go out with my friends. I'll just do nothing useful. And I guess I'm very lucky that I've ended up where I ended up, but I didn't know I was going to end up here. I was just very, very lucky. I don't think this is the life path for most people. And actually, I think that you need to plan long in advance to get to where you actually think you want to be, you know, and this is just alien to modern philosophy, completely alien. And in fact, it's a form of oppression, probably, in most of it, frankly.
So with this course, we're telling people fundamentally start listening to your noble nature.
Yes.
Start waking up to the hierarchies,
yes,
of your soul and of your being and personhood.
And of life.
And of life. Learn to say no to the less noble elements. And also have the metaphysical ground to make sense of this.
Correct.
Because one of the major problems with materialistic metaphysics is that we can't make sense of morality and of ourselves as moral agents. So I think that this is something that is really important. And I wish I was told this when I was younger.
I wish I'd had this drilled into me at school.
Yeah,
I'm sure I'd be more successful than I am now if I had. So let's go through the structure of the course. So as I understand, it's the introduction and then 8 lectures.
Yeah.
So it's 14 and a half hours of lectures.
I think it's somewhere there.
Which is a long course. That's a big course. Yeah. It's not a small undertaking.
Yeah.
You know, this is serious stuff. And there's a reading list for each lecture, obviously. But I assume it's not the entire books, it's just sections of books, is it?
Yeah, I mean, as with everything, the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. Right, so the course is involves an introduction that's about half an hour.
Yeah.
And is very basic.
Sure.
It sort of gives some fundamental tools for people to understand ethical theorizing and ethics better. And 8 lectures. Mm-hmm. Now, let me say a bit about introduction. I think it's a very important one because I think philosophy is something that most people love or hate depending on how they were introduced to it. Mm. Because there are, unfortunately, so many philosophers, academia has lots of them, who just talk about the subject and make it incredibly uninteresting.
Yes.
And just someone who isn't instantly drawn into it just for its own sake, will say, right, okay, but how is that important? How does it help?
That's the problem. It's the disconnect. It's spoken of entirely in the abstract, yes, as if it doesn't have a bearing on the here and now in real life. But actually, no, it really does. And it informs the decisions that you make. And that's what you need to train.
Exactly. So in the very beginning, I introduce how some basics of ethical philosophy in terms of how they relate to first-person experience. Mm. I think that's the best avenue to enter into it, because most people, as Aristotle said, try to understand the less familiar in terms of the more familiar. Mm. And there's nothing more familiar than first-person experience. So I'm talking about moral experience, moral judgment, and then ethical theorizing, how we are trying to organize the verdicts of our moral judgment. And then we have 8 lectures.
Well, before we go on, this is another real strength of Alistair McIntyre, temporalizing ideas. Like, it's very easy when you're doing philosophy or any kind of thinking, really, to look at the tradition that came before you and assume that it kind of floats outside of time and space, because I can pick up a manuscript from Descartes or something 400 years later and be like, oh yeah, and feel like I'm having a conversation with him. But no, he's very much a product of his time and place, actually. All ideas are actually a product of their time and place. And so having a proper understanding of the context that leads up to a certain set of ideas actually gives you mastery over the ideas. The ideas are not just abstract and imposed upon you from the divine form of Marxism or whatever it is. It's actually, no, you can see how this is coming out of the Industrial Revolution as a reaction to the centralization of capital and labor. Like, these things suddenly become much more comprehensible. And that's what I think the point of, like, lecture 2 is, or lecture 1 actually is.
Well, yeah. And now lecture 2 is a lecture that is talking about myth. And the 7 stages of antiquity. Mm. And I think that in it, people will like it, because myth is something that is very appealing to many people. It's very majestic. It's very easy to get into it. It's very cool in some respects. I think everyone loves myths.
But it's also just value setting. This is where values are set.
Exactly.
Like, there's a reason that Alexander slept with a copy of the Iliad under his pillow and wanted to emulate Achilles as an example. Yeah. Like, it's myths are where we set values. And so you told me before we talked about this, like, look, it's actually in these mythologies that the birth of philosophy comes.
Exactly. Yes. Right. So lecture number 2 dispenses completely with the Enlightenment myth, according to which everything before Enlightenment reason is darkness, and there comes reason, which is the light. According to, I think, a more sophisticated view on things, suggests that philosophy is a brighter light. Mm. And it's very interesting to look at how philosophy arises from intellectual and cultural factors of the time.
Yeah.
Right, so lecture number 2 is about ethical teachings in pre-philosophical traditions. Mm. And I start by saying that ethical teachings and ethical reflection doesn't begin with philosophical reflection about ethics. Mm. And I'm talking there about the myths. I'm talking about Hesiod's Theogony, Hesiod's Work and Days, a bit about Iliad and the Odyssey, and a bit about Antigone, mm, and also about a chapter, I think it's in Sophocles' Ajax, mm-hmm, where there's a battle there's rivalry between Odysseus and Ajax of Telamon about who's going to get Achilles' armor. Mm. And that essentially shows different philosophies of warfare. Mm. We part with the Achilles versus Hector 1v1
yeah,
mode of warfare, which Ajax of Telamon, who was number 2 in everything, you know, because Achilles was number 2 in everything. And we go with a much more, you know, surgical hit, drone strike view of warfare with Odysseus.
But the point of the story is to impart a moral lecture, right? The point of the story is to teach you something about morality.
Exactly.
And that's why Hollywood stories are terrible now, because they've forgotten that that's the point of a story. And in fact, they do still lecture you, but it's on a backwards morality about woke intersectionality. But that's why philosophy comes out of these myths and stories. It becomes something important that we continue on.
And let me just give you a very brief example, which I gave in the lecture. The myth of Theseus can be interpreted as having profound ethical insights, mm-hmm. such as don't let success intoxicate you to the degree that you forget your promises.
Yes.
Because Theseus slayed the Minotaur, and in the partying, he forgot his promise to his father, Aegeus, to change his sails from black to white. And his father saw black sails and thought his son was dead, and he killed himself. Yep. So there are profound ethical dimensions in mythology. Right. Lecture number three is about the birth of ethical philosophy from the pre-philosophical traditions mm-hmm. and the realities of ancient Greek city-states, particularly Athenian democracy. As I say it in very... In a bit simplistic way, but I think it's a good start. There were two kinds of factors, intellectual and cultural factors. Intellectual factors had to do with a metaphysical stalemate at the time between Heraclitus and Parmenides. Mm. Most people interpreted Heraclitus as saying everything is in motion, in flux. Most people interpreted Parmenides as saying change is an illusion. And there wasn't a metaphysical mastermind to create a way out of this up until Plato. So people focused from metaphysical to ethical matters. And then there was the realities of Athenian democracy, which was exceptionally litigious and conflict driven.
It was very vibrant.
Very vibrant, yeah. And I think it's a good way of thinking about it, is that as civilization advances, there is more conflict and there is more of a need to solve conflict. There's a need for conflict resolution. And when we have a relative balance of powers between factions within a city state or city states at large, there is discourse. There isn't a right of conquest. There is discourse about what a fair principles for conflict resolution. Mm. And that's what drew all the intellect of the ethical philosophers with respect to it. Just the question is, what are the principles for governing a society? That's why one of the main tasks for the wise sage was to draft a constitution.
Yes. And this happened all the time in ancient Greece as well.
Yeah.
A city would find itself with two powerful factions that are just... irreconcilable. One couldn't defeat the other, and they couldn't come to an agreement. So they would literally request a philosopher from a foreign city to come in and give them their constitution, to which they would all have to abide, because it would be assumed that he's not personally invested in one of the factions, but he would be well-educated and able to create them something based in reason that would actually satisfy their needs.
Yes, and it wasn't just foreigners. It was sometimes from the metropolis, going to colonies. Yeah. So lecture number three is about sophists and Socrates.
Yes.
And I'm talking about the sophists in a more sophisticated way.
The sophists have a very bad reputation, but they don't really deserve it. They're not all terrible.
Right.
They're not great.
Right. I think
but they're not all terrible.
There is an olive branch.
I think so. But anyway, we won't go into it.
No, but really, really quickly to say, because I think that it's a really interesting thing. Plato didn't like the sophists.
I know.
But there's a good case to be made that he didn't think everyone was as bad.
Yeah.
I think he did have some respect for Protagoras and Gorgias. Mm. And essentially his main problem was that if you deny objectivity to such an extent, you're going to be led to the position of Callicles and Thrasymachus, who are the real villains of Plato.
Yes.
Right. Lecture number four is about the ethics in Plato's Republic. I think you're going to like Plato's Republic after this.
You know, it's going to be a hard sell.
Yeah, but I think it's a high stakes sell, and I'm willing to bet.
Okay, well, I guess we'll see. Right, I guess we'll see.
So it's a very I think one of the most profound texts of all time.
Yeah. And I mean, it is. There's no. Yeah. It holds the place in the Western canon that it holds for a reason.
But also, I think it holds the place as a lifelong companion, because I don't agree with everything in it.
No, of course.
There's much I disagree with. Yeah. with him in it, but I think it has earned its place in,
of course,
as and, a life companion.
My objections to Plato are almost like a meme at this point. Like, you know, to give him his due, you can't deny the brilliance of his work, whether you agree with that or not.
Yes. So. Lecture number 5 is about the goat.
Yep.
Aristotle and virtue in Nicomachean Ethics.
And this is the one that just, it really is the gold standard for me.
Yeah.
I love Aristotle.
And I represent Aristotle on his own terms. Mm-hmm. And in fact, all of the ancient Greco-Romans on their own terms.
Yeah.
I'm not doing a Marxist or third wave feminist.
No, we want to actually get the best out of it.
We are looking at antiquity on its own terms.
Yeah.
And I'm showing how ridiculous it is to portray Aristotle as an empiricist in the modern sense.
No, his philosophy is entirely normative.
He does have this elevated conception of human nature.
Of course.
That the empiricists of modern times are completely trying to destroy.
He believes there's a purpose to a human life. We can't have that.
Exactly.
And we literally can't believe that.
And he has a very thorough exposition.
I know, it's brilliant.
He has a very thorough exposition of virtue ethics, and he has, in a way, codified it in a really good way with a golden mean. And one of the things that I want to do with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle is to dispense with another myth, the myth that they constantly despise tradition.
Yeah, no, not at all.
It's completely mistaken.
No.
They did dislike features of it, but one of the main issues they took with it was that it couldn't sustain some of the most important aspects of it. So let me give you a very brief example. Plato didn't like mythology, the mythological tradition, and the poets of the time. But one of the reasons why he disliked them was that he thought that if you actually pay close attention to mythology, you will see that the notion of divinity that is intuitive to us from a first-person perspective isn't really done justice in ancient Greek mythology.
Well, his objection to poets and artists in general was based in they don't really know what they're talking about.
Yes.
They're fictionally presenting something, but they have no real understanding of it.
Yes. So. Lecture number 6 is about a very chilled out bro. It's about Epicurus.
I don't like Epicurus.
I think he is very misinterpreted. I think
I know. I'm not being fair to him.
He is a hedonist, but he's not in favor of debauchery. His notion of pleasure is different. But he did like some wine here or there. Yeah. I think so.
Aristotle's not saying don't drink wine or anything. It's
correct.
Just don't drink too much wine.
Correct.
And don't drink at the wrong time of the day. Make sure you're in a social setting. Make sure you drink just enough.
Correct. But I think that what is really important to understand here about the time, and this links really well with what you said before about Alistair MacIntyre and and his idea, his really strong idea of the times that are associated with intellectual fashions. Epicurus comes at a very turbulent time in the Greek world. I think he lived during the wars of the successors of Alexander the Great.
Right. Well,
where essentially the Athenian Greeks, the city-states were sort of collapsing.
Well, they were conquered. They were all parts of empires.
But it was also the culture of them that collapsed. Yeah. And most people weren't citizens. Mm, And they weren't citizens in the sense that ancient Athenian direct democracy featured lots of citizens.
Personal involvement.
Yeah, so the focus changes there from the active engagement in politics to a more modern, if you'd like, setting. It's like, you know, the cultivation of the self, take care of your well-being. And it's interesting because this is the Hellenistic ethics. And at the same time, I mean, not at the same time with Cicero, with Epicurus, but at the during the Hellenistic ethical framework and paradigm, we also had Cicero, who was very much against it. He preferred the Stoics to Epicurus. And his main problem with Epicurus was that he doesn't take account of the importance of engaging in politics. Mm. Now, who got the last laugh? I don't know.
Well, I mean, the world is a lot more Epicurean than it is Ciceronian.
But also Epicurus, Cicero got into lots of trouble, but also he gave things that an Epicurean wouldn't be able to but get. The, but he earned glory in that respect.
But the point is, they're both kind of reflections of the same problem, right? The breakdown of the moral substrate in which people feel that they belong, yeah, in which they're situated.
Yeah.
Like you said, the culture of the city-state is breaking down. So the morality that these people are following is kind of, you know, slipping through their fingers. So they have to think of something else. So a Stoic says, right, okay, I retreat entirely into myself and sort of create a walled fortress where whatever happens, happens on the outside. That's not, I'm not in control of any of it. That's whatever happens is not my business, really. My business is to maintain a kind of Buddha-like focus on my inner, like, yeah, rectitude or whatever. And Epicurus, yeah, like, as you say, like, well, just treat yourself well, enjoy what you can while you can. These are both responses to the breakdown of the moral substrate.
Exactly, yes. And let us be a bit fair to him.
I'm not even saying they're wrong. Yeah. Like, it's probably a very rational, yeah, response at the time.
Yeah. No, but it's also fair to some people who are drawn to him, because there comes a time where some people say, right, I had enough of involvement in politics. I'm out. I don't think it's productive, but for some people, not everyone has the same life trajectory and the same desires.
This is why Aristotle's got us covered.
The same aptitudes. Yeah.
If you're a citizen, you're a man of the city. If you can vote, you've got to care about politics.
Exactly. But let's say someone isn't as engaged as others. There is much wisdom to be found in Epicurus.
Yes.
He has some really good advice when it comes to personal well-being and how we view life. He has a very chilling effect. You feel like you're with the Big Lebowski sometimes when you're meeting him. So there is something there that is...
I mean, he would have been fun to hang out with. He would have been nice to have just...
The Jeff Bridges-like type of friend. Lecture number 7 is about Stoics.
These are not so fun.
I'm trying to point attention to Stoicism as a movement there, because most people think that Stoicism starts with Seneca, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius. Yeah. It doesn't. They are late Stoics. By the time Seneca was born, Stoicism was around 300 years old. Mm-hmm. It began before 300 BC.
Yeah.
With Zeno of Citium in the famous Stoa of Athens. Yes. And I'm talking about
how it got the name.
Yeah, the different phases of Stoicism. And then I'm focusing on some fundamental aspects of the Stoic worldview, which I think has some merit, especially for people who live through adversity in very adverse conditions. And in some cases, they may think that they can't go back to a more active, engaged lifestyle. I think that in some cases it's very good for people of this persuasion, but it also has some good insights for everyone.
Yes.
But one thing that is interesting in Stoicism, which is a bit challenging, and it's something that we should mention when we're talking about Stoicism, is that the idea of the Stoic sage is very much influencing, but I think the Stoics are trying to sell just that thing. And they're trying to say that the fundamental journey of the Stoic sage is an inner journey. Yeah. It's a journey that Isaiah Berlin described as a retreat into the inner citadel, and it's fundamentally psychological. Mm. And they're saying essentially that you need to become the Stoic sage, and the Stoic sage is the person who understands that everything that happens, happens for good. And they're characterized by essentially a love of fate and fatalism. They call it, I think in Latin it's called amor fati.
Yes.
Which, you know, it's not everyone's cup of tea, but...
But there are some virtues to it. There's, you know, there will be times in your life when you would need to be able to call upon this kind of worldview.
Yeah.
If nothing else, you know, I mean, you know, again, I hate to go back to sort of Jordan Peterson, because it feels lazy to do so, but, you know, at your father's funeral, you've got to be the rock.
I think that this is not something unique in Stoicism,
but
I think that this is Stoics have a very good way of talking to people who experience adversity.
Yes.
And I think that this is going to be a good lecture. Lecture number 8 is about a school of thought that is as influential as it is unknown.
Yeah, it's mysterious.
Yeah, it's Neoplatonism. Yeah,
you say Neoplatonism and everyone's like, oh, well, that sounds important, but I don't know anything about it.
Exactly. So Neoplatonism is just crazily influential. It's crazily influential. but they were really bad in marketing because they didn't call themselves Neoplatonists. They thought essentially, we can describe them as perennialists. Mm-hmm. And they thought that there is such a thing as eternal wisdom mm-hmm. that was really closely communicated to the first Greeks because due to their proximity to the gods, but was somehow lost from their equivalent of modernity.
Yeah.
It was inadequately captured by Pythagoras. They love Pythagoras. That's why they do lots of symbols and mathematics and stuff. And then it was better captured by Plato, who was communicating it in chunks because he was communicating it to those who were worthy of becoming initiated. Mm-hmm. And he had some secret teachings that weren't for the ears of the uninitiated and the unworthy. Right, so I start with Plotinus. Plotinus was born in 204 AD mm-hmm. and died in 270 AD. And I focus just on his Enneads, which were texts that were compiled by his student Porphyry. I'm talking about virtue in Plotinus. I'm talking about how completely otherworldly his view is. And how someone can read it and say, right, where's the ethics in it? It's almost entirely metaphysical, but his view of ethics is metaphysical, is also ethical, because in his mind, the universe he's talking about, and he is and whose hierarchy is describing, is also a universe with a hierarchy of values, yeah. And essentially he says the fundamental problem is upwards or downwards. He implicitly says this. That's in all Platonism.
Yeah.
And he says we need to go back to the source, essentially. And then he has the one, which is the ideal, the form of the good in Plato. He called it the one. He's a very original thinker, but he didn't take himself to be that original. That's why they called themselves Platonists.
Yeah, interesting.
Right. And then that's the focus of the lecture. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting message, a very otherworldly one, though. And it influenced Islamic, Jewish, Christian mysticism, the philosophy of Christianity. Saint Augustine of Hippo was a Neoplatonist for many years. The language of Neoplatonism is informing theological debates about the nature of the Trinity. Then in the Renaissance, we have Marsilio Ficino and Pico della Mirandola, who were Neoplatonists, trying to bring Neoplatonism back. It never really went away in Byzantium. It's crazily influential. And
it's really interesting. So I've never read Plotinus, actually.
It's just...
You're really selling him to me, frankly.
Yeah,
it sounds interesting to read, if nothing else.
Yeah, it's just insanely otherworldly thinking.
Yeah,
just, you know,
I like it.
Some people say that he was annoyed that he had a body because he identified with the reason
in
himself. Says just this is the high element and good. And... right, and lecture number 9 goes back to Plato's Symposium.
Right.
I'll say this, I didn't plan it initially. I was planning for 8 lectures in total, but I thought that we had to end with a more wholesome message.
Yes, because Plotinus is a bit, okay, how does this map onto what I'm actually doing in my daily life?
Yeah, he was tripping. He's total tripping philosopher, but really profound.
Yeah.
And we go back to Plato's Symposium because I think it's after the Republic is his best...
Without a doubt, yeah.
His best text.
Yeah.
And it is a very good way of introducing, of showing how the principles we are talking about throughout the course apply to a specific case. There's one of the most important things in life, which is love. And I'm showing the clash between the various views there, the various perspectives, because there are many speeches in it, and Socrates takes an issue with all of them for different reasons, and he completely rejects Aristophanes, who essentially says love is lust. And that's interesting because Aristophanes, in that dialogue, if Plato was completely fair to him, he sort of represents the view that not all moderns share, but
many do,
but most of people who accept the modern framework and assumptions of it we mentioned before seem to be gravitating towards. Because if we are a battlefield of desires, and love is just an imbalance of chemicals in the brains, and just let the strongest desire win, not only do we equate love with lust, we also find ourselves in some very problematic ways of people starting to normalize things that intuitively we're saying this shouldn't be normalized.
Stelios, have you considered that love is love?
Yes.
That's literally their argument is, well, whatever we do is good by the definition of what it is, and we've done it.
So
I disagree with, obviously, but you can see how this all maps back onto exactly what is happening now. These are ancient conversations that have been had many, many millennia ago, but because we've lost our connection to this tradition, they become relevant again.
Exactly. I think that this was also, I felt really well when I ended with that lecture, because I wanted to end on a less otherworldly note.
Yeah, no, something
was because
really substantive.
It is substantive, and I think that the final lecture will be the lecture that people will probably like the most. Good. It's very uplifting, and it really shows how we're completely done an injustice by the modern worldview, and how by recapturing some aspects of antiquity, we can actually solve the problem of fragmentation that we mentioned in the very beginning.
That's absolutely superb. So what we'll do is we'll end this discussion there, but the conversation will not actually end there. There'll be a link in the description if you want to go and get the course, because I really think, and I really mean this, like I think that actually it is our job in this time and this place to start putting all of this back together. And that's why I asked Stelios to do this course, and that's the purpose of this course, is so we can actually start reconstructing what a truly moral life actually is. So the link will be in the description if you'd like to go and get it now. But we are also going to do a webinar where we answer questions. It'll be a Zoom call that you can get a link to. It'll be free. You just can, we'll put it up on the website. Just follow the link in the description. There'll be a link to the webinar at 3 p.m. on Thursday, the 9th of October, 2025. So Stelios and I will just be there to answer your questions and discuss what the course is about, the reason we've got to do this. And I really think this is a part of the reconstruction of the West more broadly. And I think that without someone undergoing a project like this, then the job will never be done. I just think we fall into the modern, immoral, rules-based order. And that's the future unless we do something about it. So we will see you at Thursday on the 9th of October at 3 p.m. Come and join us. Like I said, it's going to be free, so we're just going to hang out and talk and explain exactly why this is so important. And if you want the course, the link is in the description, or go to courses.lotuses.com and pick it up there. And thanks for watching, folks.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Using my GI Bill taught me I can do anything. And seeing me graduate taught my daughter she can too. VA benefits cover tuition, housing, and supplies. Get what you earned. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner. So you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.